Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas. Michael, on our show today, we're going to be talking with the director of UNC Hospital's Beacon program, Melinda Manning, about eliminating and preventing domestic violence, and specifically to talk about violence in intimate relationships. A really critically important topic, isn't it?
This is very important. I've worked with Beacon before in the past, and I'm really looking forward to her being here today, and I'm glad to be back again, Adam.
Yeah, you know, we bring this topic to our listeners because it continues to be one that affects societies around the globe. But first, we're going to talk about some research that matters. And our very first research is about growing brains in a petri dish. And I'm not saying this as if it's science fiction.
I'll tell you, the last time I used a petri dish, I was looking at bacteria and the effects of garlic. So I think this is just a little more advanced than what I was doing back in middle school.
Yeah, what's this research about?
So this is really interesting. They are taking out of Luxembourg skin samples and essentially turning them into three-dimensional brain-like cultures. And so what they're doing, this was actually reported in the Journal of Stem Cell Reports, and what they did was they took, through a process that's called inducing pluripotent stem cells, a particular type of stem cell, and are actually able to turn it into an organ.
Yeah, because stem cells are the ones that we can kind of have them go anywhere we want if with the proper influence and direction, and they're essentially growing it into brain tissue that theoretically at the cellular level could look, act, and respond like brain tissue. And then in this particular case, they're talking about, well, maybe you can accelerate certain diseases within this cell population, like Parkinson's disease.
And this is particularly important for many of our patients that I know that we both have, Adam. And they're looking particularly at the human midbrain, which is where Parkinson's is particularly affected. And just to be clear, with these particular stem cells, these stem cells cannot produce a complete organism, okay? So they were really looking at specific cell types, particularly like the brain in an organism.
And it allows potentially, and we like it because it is not something that we're knowing the effects right now, but and seeing on diseases, but we could see in the not too distant future diseases like Parkinson's, diseases like ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, diseases of other brain disorders, possibly even things like MS, multiple sclerosis, things that we don't have perfect treatments, some cases no treatments, we might develop better treatments.
And it really may actually help to reduce the amount of animal testing that's done in brain research. So a couple of different positive benefits and may also have some other opportunities in collaboration as well across the globe with neurocognitive and brain disorders.
So we're going to support it. We hope you will consider supporting that type of research as well.
Absolutely.
Speaking of supporting, I think many of us could get behind this next research that matters, and we don't have to invest a lot of money.
As long as you can run.
Yes, as long as you can run, which a lot of people can't run for lots of different reasons. But a lot of people could run. A lot of people could walk. And the question is, does, in this case, running, which perhaps could be same thing as fast walking, increase your lifespan?
Absolutely. This was published in the Journal of Progress in Cardiovascular Disease, and what they reported was individuals who run tend to live about 3 years longer than those who don't.
And this was an association. This was not necessarily a cause and effect, but they calculated about a one-hour run could translate to additional 7 hours added to a person's life. Now, I think most of us would say, well, if I could do something for an hour and it gave me 7 hours longer life, and this that would be good. Now, that benefit was seen in that association for up to 3 years. It, once you accumulate that kind of benefit, it's kind of like working for 3 years in a at a place. You know, whether it's going to help you get another raise after that, who knows?
And not to discourage anybody that can't run, for folks who were walking or cycling, it was also linked to a longer lifespan. It just wasn't to the same degree. So we're not saying if you can't run, don't get out there and essentially don't do anything. I think those things are incredibly valuable for cardiac health and for cholesterol and metabolism altogether.
So should if you've not been running before, should you just get out there and go for that hour run?
I don't know. It might hurt.
Yeah, and I think we always say start slow and go low initially. You have to work your way up to this. But certainly you could talk with your healthcare provider about an exercise regimen.
Yeah.
That would be a good thing.
Prescription exercise.
Yeah, let's talk about our very next research that matters. And I think this really does matter. And that is if you have to go in for surgery, and I said there's a way for you to save money, shorten your recovery, and there's not much side effects, I bet you would want it.
Sign me up for surgery. I mean, a shorter stay in the hospital.
Yeah, that's right. Not for the surgery, but for the stay. And this is some really using some basic information that we know about fitness and stress reduction, as well as smoking cessation, but doing it before someone goes in for surgery and getting them ready for surgery. What a great idea.
A novel concept. I think that we try to do this with our patients. And this study was a little bit more structured. And again, it was published in Surgery. And what they found was basic fitness and wellness coaching administered in advance could reduce a surgical patient's average hospital stay 2 days from 7 down to 5, which is just pretty remarkable.
Yeah, and these were across a whole host of potential surgeries, both in the chest, organs, liver, pancreas, and they were elective surgeries, so that's an important caveat. And this, where they were working on this is in Michigan, and they call it the Michigan Surgical and Health Optimization Program. We're going to ask our wonderful health sciences librarians to put this link to this program on our website because it's an important, I think, program, and it's something that really could be done, should be done, I think, in most hospitals across the country.
Absolutely. Completely agree.
Let's talk about our very last research that matters. And this is about infant mortality and perhaps disparities in infant mortality between African-American babies and other infants.
Yeah, this was really troubling. So this was a study that looked at overall infant mortality from 2000 to 2013. And they looked at black infant mortality, which was at 11.1 deaths per 1,000 live births versus 5.1 for every 1,000 white newborns. And this was published in the American Journal of Public Health. Now, looking at this a little bit further, there have been improved rates overall nationally. But what's concerning is that there's still a disparity.
Right. They found that the kind of the gap is narrowing, which really is good because we've been working, we've been hearing about, talking about, trying to do some implementation of it. It's much easier to identify the disparity than it is, I think, sometimes to intervene on it. But there were three states that had great improvements in reducing the infant mortality by at least 30%, and that was Arizona, Iowa, and Massachusetts. But there were also a couple states where it went up over this period of time. This was over a 13-year period from 2000 to 2013. And the states that maybe didn't improve, maybe got a little worse, were New Jersey, Illinois, and actually the worst state, Kansas. I don't know why. If I were policymakers in Kansas, I'd be pulling out the stops.
Absolutely. And again, this is important to focus on the fact that the leading causes of infant mortality are low birth weight, preterm deliveries, birth defects, and pregnancy complications. And so, you know, I think a lot of this can really, you can look back and say that some of this may stem from poor access to care during pregnancy. And again, during the study, they didn't actually look at Latino babies either. So that was not included.
Yeah, we'll ask our health sciences librarians if they can put up a link to the table that shows the different states. This was not all states. I think it was like 35 states. Mm-hmm. But it's a great snapshot. We're making progress, but there is more to be done. Well, that'll conclude the Research Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. When we return, Michael and I will be talking with the director of the UNC Hospital's Beacon Program, Melinda Manning, about violence and intimate relationships and the continuing effects it has. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Bacchialis. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine.
Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Bacchiatlis. Today on Conversations, Michael, we're talking with the director of the University of North Carolina Hospital's Beacon Program, Melinda Manning, about violence in intimate relationships and the effects it can have.
Welcome, Melinda. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, your path here is an interesting path, and I think it'd be interesting for our listeners to know a little bit more about you and how you became interested in this, going from your work as a lawyer, attorney, and associate dean of students, and then into this kind of work now.
Sure. I actually first started doing this work actually as an undergraduate student at UNC. I'm actually a triple UNC graduate. And I really became passionate, particularly about sexual violence as an undergraduate. I kind of went away for it for a while, but I did return to UNC to go to law school and worked as a dorm director. And working as a dorm director, you unfortunately also see a lot of both sexual violence and relationship violence as well. And that led to me, when I graduated from law school, going into the Dean of Students office, where I worked for 11 years. Decided it was time for a change for a number of reasons, and actually went back to school to get my master's of social work. And this Beacon position just kind of opened up at the right time, and it seemed like a really good fit kind of for my mixture of skills and passion.
So let me just clarify. You didn't work in the dormitory after you got your law degree. That was
No. I was a dorm director while I got my law degree.
Okay, I was a little worried there. Maybe,
yeah,
you know,
no. That, well, the job market is hard for lawyers, but not quite that tough. No, that was actually how I helped pay for my law degree.
And the issues, just talk for a second about what are some of the issues that you were seeing? You mentioned in the dormitories. I'd be kind of curious because I don't think people would necessarily initially think about maybe sexual violence and physical violence.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first thing is that the 18 to 24 age group of young women is at the highest risk for sexual violence. We know that. Whether they're in college or out of college, that is the highest risk group. And so, but very often, these young people, they don't get help. They're embarrassed. They're ashamed. It's their first time away from home. And so a lot of times they suffer in silence. And so, you know, I felt like one of my jobs, both working as a dorm director, but then later the dean of students office, was to make it easier and more comfortable for students to come forward and report. Also, very similar issues with relationship violence. I know for me, it was kind of a process to really understand that relationship violence didn't just exist among married couples. I think that we have a particular stereotype that who relationship violence really exists for, but it happens to individuals at all phases of life and even college students. And so again, the real challenge was to make it so that students could come forward and get help for whatever they were going through.
And I've seen just recently in the press, I mean, something like 1 in 4 women on college campuses, numbers like that. Mm-hmm. How, since you started at UNC till now, how have things changed with awareness, advocacy, on campus?
It's changed tremendously, really, in a very positive direction. When I first started in the Dean of Students office in 2001, my then boss at the time said, "Hey, Melinda, I need you to kind of work on this sexual assault problem." At that point, there was no infrastructure. We did have a policy, but really didn't have a lot else to back it up. We did have some passionate people on campus who really worked on the problem, particularly some folks in student health. You know, you fast forward to now, and there is this pretty large Title IX office with a number of full-time staff people working on the issue. They also, even more importantly in some ways, there's staff working on the prevention side, because ultimately we would like to prevent every sexual assault, every case of relationship violence. And so that in some ways I think is particularly important. That did not exist back in 2001. But also the students are really passionate and educated about this issue in ways that I never could have imagined when I first started working there, or even when I was an undergraduate student. The students are savvy. They really know what they want, but they also really have done their research. They really have sat down and read the journal articles and really are trying to figure out what are the best ways to talk to their peers about these issues. And it's incredibly inspiring to see.
When we talk about sexual violence, domestic violence, and intimate partner relationships, what are we really talking about? Are we talking about marriage, spouses? Are we talking about intergeneration families? What are we talking about?
Yeah, I think it's important to think about that sexual violence can just really happen just in all kinds. I mean, first thing, we know that most cases are between two people who know each other. Stranger sexual assault is relatively rare when you look at kind of overall cases. But really, sexual violence can happen in all types of relationships. It certainly can be, you know, among two people who are married. Even though North Carolina did not really recognize sexual assault within a marriage until the mid-90s. I think we're the last state to do so, unfortunately. And so a lot of people don't really recognize sexual assault occurring within a committed relationship. I think the assumption is that it's always going to be consensual. And then, unfortunately, as a program, I can tell you we do see a lot of sexual violence occurring among individuals with disabilities are at higher risk, we know, and even the elderly, right? So you certainly do have people, perpetrators, who will also really prey on the elderly, particularly those that maybe lack capacity as well.
You know, I see now when I'm in clinic and doing screening with my own patients, mm-hmm. you know, that I had, you know, used the language of intimate partner violence, and I mm-hmm. kind of got a blank stare back and then had to take a step back mm-hmm. again. You know, I think people are more familiar with domestic violence, but I do believe that, you know, being on the same page, using language that everyone can relate to is important. What is the difference sure. between those two things, or if they're different at all?
Yeah. So intimate partner violence really is the term that, say, researchers and actually our college students actually use a lot as well. Is one thing. I mean, that's kind of the new term. The reason a lot of people prefer it is that it's more of an umbrella term. We think intimate partner violence encompassing kind of all forms of violence. So that really can include domestic violence, relationship violence, sexual violence, and stalking as well. So it's really one that really covers. And I think eventually the language is going to change and it's going to really become the preferred term, but that's going to be a process. So I know particularly when I'm doing educational presentations around the hospital, I tend to use domestic violence more in my talks because that is a term that most of our patients as well as most of our staff recognize. But intimate partner violence or IPV really is kind of the preferred term for a lot of us.
And I think that domestic violence can sometimes maybe be a little bit limiting in mm-hmm. a way. So I know that it may just take maybe yeah. more time.
Yeah, I stopped using the term domestic violence when I worked with college students because, again, I think students really kind of had this image of being married, having a house with a white picket fence. That's kind of what they associated with the term domestic violence. They didn't seem that term really being applicable to what they were going through.
So for our listeners who may not have ever heard of Beacon, mm-hmm. why that name and what is your mission and vision?
Sure. Sure. So, like I said, I'm only the second ever director of the Beacon program. The Beacon program has been around for actually, I think it'll be 21 years this summer. So when we think about Beacon, we think about we're there to give hope. These are incredibly difficult issues. And so our number one job really is to give hope to the patients and employees, because we also work with employees as well.
And that would be for anyone who interacts within the healthcare system or even broader?
So we officially don't turn anyone away. We really do work with, again, patients and employees within the UNC healthcare system. But again, anyone who calls us, we're going to try to help.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. But when we return, maybe you can walk us through what a typical day could look like. We're going to take a short break, but then we'll continue talking with the director of UNC Hospital's Beacon program, Melinda Manning, about violence and intimate relationships and the effects it can have. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Bacalis. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Bacalis. We've been talking with the director of UNC Hospital's Beacon program, Melinda Manning, about violence in intimate relationships and the effects it can have.
Melinda, I wonder if you could also just share, you know, what's a typical day look like? Because I'm sure that it's not easy at times, mm-hmm. and yet it can be immensely gratifying when you're helping. Give us an example.
Sure. You know, I think one thing about this work is that no 2 days are alike because we do get very unique cases. And we also, not only do we provide direct services, we also have been spending more of our time doing education and awareness as well, because we think those are equally important parts of our mission as well. But, you know, a typical day, a first thing is that, you know, a lot of cases will come in overnight and the staff will divvy up the cases. So the cases could be, you know, a case of suspected elder abuse. It could be a patient that was admitted overnight to the burn unit whose partner actually set them on fire. Unfortunately, that's an all too common scenario that we see a lot of times in our work. It also could be calls from outpatient clinics where when they've done the screening for domestic violence, a patient has said, you know, yes, I'm experiencing violence at home, and I would like to talk to someone about that. And so we actually are doing an increasing amount of our work over the phone with our outpatient clinics because we think that's also vitally important as well for what we do. Some of our cases will take hours, literally. It will involve one of our social workers going to up to one of the floors and sitting and talking with that patient. Sometimes coming up with a safety plan for after they leave the hospital. Sometimes one of the things we recently have learned how to do, we've all become certified in how to do danger assessments so we can actually assess the amount of lethality in a particular relationship. Sometimes we'll go through those with the patients as well. But it is definitely true that every day is certainly unique. In our downtime, we'll spend time doing things like working on presentations we're going to be giving. We also spend a lot, we've also been spending more of our time doing the teaching aspect since UNC is a great teaching hospital. And so we've taken on social work interns and we'll have occasional other students shadowing us because we think it's incredibly important to really, you know, show what we do and stress its importance to all of our learners at the hospital as well.
The healthcare system is complex as we all
yes.
are sitting here. and it can be, I think, a barrier for patients to report. To come to the hospital, to reach out to their primary care doctor. Mm-hmm. For those that are listening or even, you know, individuals we see in clinic and maybe we have 15 or 20 minutes, what could, you know, you maybe advise to them, you know, one or two steps that they could do, whether it's reaching out to the Beacon program or way to do that or additional ways through UNC?
Absolutely. I mean, the first thing I'd really urge patients is that, you know, UNC physicians and nurses are really great people to talk to. And so I'd say the first thing is that it is a safe place for you to talk about what's happening. I know it's scary. It's always scary, but that really is a really safe place and they will refer you. They really are going to get you, you know, to the right place. Patients can always give us a call. Also here in Orange County, we have two great agencies, both the Compass Center and the Orange County Rape Crisis Center, that are also fantastic resources. Both of them offer 24-hour hotlines. Again, it's safe, it's confidential, it's free. So, you know, we're really blessed with a lot of great resources here in Orange County.
Are there resources like that around the country? We have listeners in the U.S. nationally, internationally, and it even brings up the question of, you know, the work that Beacon may do is called upon to, think globally while acting locally. How does that actually happen in terms of how you get involved in kind of statewide or national efforts?
Sure. That is something that we hope to do more of. To answer kind of the first part of your question is that there are rape crisis centers, domestic violence agencies in most parts of the United States. Unfortunately, there are sections of the U.S. that are not covered. Now, there are national domestic violence hotlines and national sexual assault hotlines that you can Google very quickly to get those numbers as well that are available. But to be perfectly honest, unfortunately, some parts of the country don't have as good resources as we have here in Orange County, and that's really a problem. In terms of our work kind of on a national level is that we are trying to get out there more. We're hoping to present at a national conference this coming year. One thing that we did last year we're really proud of is that we actually helped a new program at the Medical University of South Carolina get started. They heard about our program. They liked our setup. They came up to visit us, and we would really love to help more hospital systems set up programs like Beacon because we really believe that our model works and that even though we certainly aren't billing for our services or making healthcare systems money, we think we're incredibly valuable service.
What do you think comes up a lot with when people, you know, ask you, you know, what is Beacon? Mm-hmm. What do you do? What are the common misconceptions that you see on a regular basis? Because there's so many people, I think, now that know about the program in the hospital, but may not be directly involved or have worked on, you know, with a client or a patient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one of the biggest areas of confusion with Beacon is that we have both a adult wing of the program and a pediatric wing because we also work with patients that are experiencing child maltreatment as well. And so a lot of people kind of get the don't realize that we do both, that we work with both adults and pediatric patients. So and we have two separate pager numbers and, you know, separate staff for each section. So a lot of people get really confused about that. Again, a lot of people don't really realize the kind of wealth of services that we can offer, that we can, you know, we actually do offer some financial assistance as well. We raise money as a program. And we do things such as, for example, since Orange County does not have a domestic violence shelter, we will put patients up in hotel rooms as needed. We will help patients with things like, you know, gas and groceries as well. And I think a lot of people don't realize that we do have that available at our disposal as well.
Melinda, if I were to have talked with you a decade ago when you were in this mm-hmm. position, and I had said, tell me about the work you're doing in human trafficking, mm-hmm. it may have been a short conversation, but it's not a short conversation now.
Yeah.
Tell us how this came to be and why this is an issue you care about.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, human trafficking has really kind of come onto the national scene, but also really here in North Carolina as well. And there's a lot of communities all across North Carolina that have become really passionate about this issue. And it's not just urban areas. There's a lot of rural areas in North Carolina that have created human trafficking task forces and have gone out and gotten grants in order to really do this work, which is incredibly exciting. But yeah, it's a relatively new phenomenon that people have really realized that this is a problem, you know, across the nation and here in North Carolina.
And how does it come to your attention?
Well, we have a lot of providers at UNC that are really savvy at spotting the warning signs, and we'll make referrals to us as well. In particular, one of our medical directors, Dr. Amy Weil, really has a lot of expertise in this area and is really instrumental, particularly in getting the victims appropriate medical care, which is important. But we can't do it alone. We do work with a lot of other agencies, particularly Salvation Army in Raleigh, in order to kind of really get all the appropriate services. So it's an incredibly challenging topic. One of the things we want to do in the future is to be able to provide more education to providers on how to spot the warning signs.
Just kind of a final thought for our listeners. Mm-hmm. You know, human trafficking, also known as kind of modern day slavery, yeah. It is a little bit confusing, I think, to identify, you know, the difference mm-hmm. between domestic violence. How does that differ from human trafficking? Mm-hmm. And what should our listeners know kind of what it truly is? I mean, it's seen in the media mm-hmm. as something maybe then a little bit different than what it really is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the big, you know, I mean, both of them are terrible things that shouldn't happen to anyone. I think let's just go ahead and put that out there. But human trafficking, you're really talking about someone who's actually kind of profiting off the labor of someone else, whether that be sexual labor or other types of labor. As well. And that other person does not have, you know, they did not enter into this willingly in any way. And in many ways, they are really trapped in the situation as well. And it's certainly we've seen pediatric victims, adult victims, we've seen victims in their 60s and 70s. So that's another thing I think really surprises a lot of people when they know that some of the victims, not all the victims of human trafficking are young. Some of them are older.
We've been talking with Melinda Manning, the director of UNC Hospital's Beacon program. Mm. Thank you so much for being a guest on Your Health Today, and even thank you more for the advocacy and work that you do for healthcare clients around this region and state of North Carolina and nationally.
Thanks so much for giving me this opportunity.
Thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
We're going to put up on our website a link to the Beacon program. Those who are interested know about the evaluation, counseling, support, consultations, medical resources, intimate partner, domestic violence, family violence, all kinds of issues. Thank you again very much. We'll take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Gold, Senator Michael Bach-Atlas. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes listening to listeners' health questions and concerns. And Laura, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send a comment to yourhealth@unc.edu. What's our very first question?
My sister told me that she was just diagnosed with something called renal tubular acidosis. That sounds really bad, is it?
Well, it certainly sounds bad.
Yeah, it doesn't sound good.
No one wants to be kind of renal acid, right?
No, that does not sound fun.
Renal tubular acidosis, sometimes called RTA, that makes sense, renal
sure.
tubular acidosis,
right.
is a condition of the kidneys where the body isn't able to absorb the right amount of nutrients that keeps the body in what we call homeostasis.
Okay.
Or it excretes too much of something, and then it causes your body to become acidotic. It retains, we call this hydrogen or the acid ions. Now, one of the hallmarks that you might hear, like when people have really bad diarrhea, you're excreting all what's called bicarb. And so you retain in that case, the acid gets retained and you become acidotic.
Okay.
And it's a metabolic, it's in the system. And your body always tries to compensate. If I become acidotic because the things are happening in my kidney, I will probably breathe a little bit faster. I'll hyperventilate because I'll try to get rid of that extra acid by hyperventilation. We call that a respiratory alkalosis. I can try to get that pH, which is where that body likes to be, mm-hmm. that neutral pH, back in align with each other. But in the cases of renal tubular acidosis, most of them are caused by other things, something happening to the kidney. Someone who has diabetes and hypertension, they have some kidney disease. The body can't quite keep that homeostatic mechanism anymore.
Okay.
And so they retain, in this particular case, often potassium as a way of trying to cope with this acidosis, and they become hyperkalemic. What makes it complicated is they can also become hypokalemic.
Okay.
Through a different mechanism, a different type of renal tubular acidosis. There are multiple types here. The big point is most of these are due to a problem at the kidney. Sometimes it's a genetic condition in a child. That could be part of something much bigger. So the key is if you have something going on, you have an acidosis that someone's seen in the blood, mm-hmm. perhaps, and you then measure a potassium, it could be low or high. That's a clue that there may be something going on. You probably want to see your doctor. You may need to see your specialist, maybe a nephrologist. It's not so easy to always diagnose. Usually once you figure it out, you can treat it. You may need to take a supplement. You may need to take extra kind of bicarb to help limit that acid production that's building up. You may need to take a potassium supplement, or alternatively, you may need to get rid of too much potassium. So that's why the treatment depends on the diagnosis. You got to get the right diagnosis.
So it sounds like our listener sister has the diagnosis, so they're on the right track.
They're on the right track. But you know what? This is almost always treatable. It rarely causes symptoms for a lot of people that are really things you have to worry about. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't ignore it.
Sure. Yep.
Does that make it less scary?
I think it does. I think it makes it much more understandable and it seems manageable in most cases. So that sounds good.
That's the truth. What's our very next house call?
Our next question is, I had a cholesterol test recently that was high, and I expected my doctor to advise me to start a low cholesterol diet. Instead, he told me that newer guidelines put me in a high-risk category and that I needed to take medication even though I have no symptoms and well-controlled high blood pressure. Isn't that overly aggressive?
Well, I'm not so certain. But what I will say is that there may be some communication issue going on here. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been in a situation where a doctor says, I just think you should take this medicine. And like most people, you probably would like, if you don't have to take a medication, you don't want to take it, right?
Sure, yeah.
And a healthy skepticism, perhaps, of taking cholesterol-lowering medication versus maybe doing things with your diet.
Well, especially if it's the first time that you've really talked about it and you haven't tried the diet approach yet, I can see where somebody would at least have this question.
Right. Well, one of the things that is new here is that we do actually have new guidelines that have been out for a couple of years. And what they attempt to do is to allow us to say, well, what's your risk of developing, in this case, maybe a heart attack or a stroke? The things that really are the killers of people as they age. And we can now give you a pretty good reading based upon your age, whether or not you have high blood pressure, how well it's controlled, whether or not you smoke, whether or not you have diabetes, and then your cholesterol level, including your HDL level, the good cholesterol, and mm-hmm. then the overall cholesterol, which reflects the bad cholesterol. And then we can kind of see, and usually if your 10-year risk of developing a heart attack or stroke is lower than 7%, we say, well, really, no matter what that value is, you wouldn't really benefit from a cholesterol-lowering mm-hmm. agent. If it's more than 10%, you probably would benefit. And we don't know so easily what to do with the 7 to 10%. In some cases, it's really striking. Someone does this test and they come out with a 20% risk of heart disease or a stroke in the next 10 years. If your doctor tells you that, what would you think?
Give me medicine if that's going to help. I mean, that's
right.
Pretty
they
high.
Say it's 3%. You say, oh, that may still seem high to you, but you know, I'd say if I'm not worried about it, maybe you know, let's then
watch
just do
it.
Our diet and other things. The simple fact is, though, diet doesn't get there. Mm-hmm. And that for most people, there's very little changes. That doesn't mean for everyone. But in these cases, the guidelines actually do recommend a moderate intensity statin or a high intensity statin, depending on your risk level. Now, some people say this overtreats. I think it gives you a framework for discussion. I think in the case where the doctor's recommending it, I'd find out why, mm-hmm. see what that risk is, and then see what you think.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. Just have a deeper conversation with your doctor.
Yeah, more data here probably, I think, stimulates more conversation, which I think is a good thing.
I agree.
What's our very next house call?
For 20 years, I've had significant anxiety. It's now well controlled with a small dose of twice-a-day Ativan. I recently got a new doctor who said I had to get off the Ativan because eventually it would either quit working or I would take too much, and she gave me a new medication called Zoloft. It doesn't work nearly as well, and my anxiety has come back. What should I do?
You're in a difficult situation here, and I do understand both perspectives. I understand your perspective that you're on a medication that's worked for a long time, and you didn't necessarily want to change it. You haven't increased your dose. Maybe you're dependent on it, but you haven't abused it by anything, and there's no indication that you've ever had a drug abuse problem. So a lot of people worry about these long-term medications. They're called benzodiazepines like Valium mm-hmm. or Ativan or clonazepam. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you were doing well. And so they've come along, they've changed your medication because they think that the SSRI, like medications, sertraline, Zoloft, Prozac, those types of medicines, Paxil, can maybe make a real difference and not have the same risk, but it didn't work as well. It could work as well. Maybe the dose they have isn't there, maybe a different one. Doesn't mean it can't. So I understand the doctor's perspective, and I even applaud the idea and the intent behind here. I think you need to go back and have a conversation with that doctor.
Yeah, it sounds like it's not working quite as well as you want it to, but I think that your doctor will be receptive to that conversation.
Yeah, and maybe you can cut down on that Ativan to once a day mm-hmm. Rather than twice a day. Maybe you increase the dose of this SSRI and see where that takes you. But I think the key is getting your symptoms really well controlled. And when you're really well controlled, sometimes it's hard to do better than that.
Now, while they're getting used to the Zoloft, is there any reason why they couldn't maybe take an Ativan occasionally as well? Or, I mean, could you kind
Absolutely.
Of combine as you are getting
Absolutely.
Used to the Zoloft and
Absolutely.
Seeing the effect?
And actually, I think it's a good idea because you'll get to see how much you're using over a period of time. So I would also say see your doctor back more frequently mm-hmm. rather than less frequently to figure out what's working and what else needs to be done. What's our very last house call?
My father was recently hospitalized with a heart attack, and he had two stents placed. When he was discharged, we were given an appointment with our primary care physician, as well as a cardiologist. Does he still need to see the primary care physician?
Well, this is one that I'd say, what does your instinct say? What does your instinct say, Laura?
My mother always says that the primary care physician is like the quarterback, and you've got to get the quarterback all the information and keep them, you know, in the loop so they can make, you know, good plays on behalf of your health. So.
Ooh, I love that. I love that analogy.
Yeah.
So you might have a star running back who literally is in the Hall of Fame, but if you don't have a quarterback handing off to that star running back, that may not be quite as effective, right?
Yeah.
Or faking out and different things. I love that analogy.
Yeah.
My bias, of course, I am a family physician here.
I wonder what you'll say.
Is that it's really helpful because there, mm-hmm. you know, maybe in the first month, 2-3 months, that when you're having the issues that are really just around the cardiology follow-up, it may not be as important. But over time, you know, there's lots of questions. You know, you might have questions relating to going back to work or things about sexual function and relationships that mm-hmm. the cardiologist may or may not be there to answer. They may not be obvious when it happens right there. You're going to develop new things that are going on. Lots of questions that come up. And I love the quarterback because the quarterback can sometimes just answer the questions even if they're not the ones that are doing the treatment, right?
Exactly.
They can help you read the defense.
Right. And there's so much that goes on in the body that, you know, why not keep the person who's looking at the whole picture in the loop?
I like your answer. Well, we want to thank you for joining us today for your health, and we hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can share your own questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or just search for our health app, Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guest today, Melinda Manning. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.